The fall of Dalton Trumbo took him from being one of Hollywood's highest paid writers to a Hollywood pariah. He wrote the scripts for dozens of movies in the 30s and 40s, among them Kitty Foyle and 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. His anti-war novel, Johnny Got His Gun, won the National Book Award in 1939. Then, in 1947, Dalton Trumbo was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, part of the Hollywood Ten, questioned about their ties to the Communist Party. Dalton Trumbo refused to testify based on his First Amendment rights guaranteeing free speech.
I believe I have the right to be confronted with any evidence which supports this question. I should like to see what you have.
Oh, well, you would.
Yeah.
Well, you will pretty soon. Witness is excused.
This is the beginning.
Dalton Trumbo is saying there, this is the beginning of an American concentration camp for writers. And for Dalton Trumbo, it was the beginning of the end of the writing life he had known. He was found in contempt of Congress, was kicked out of the Screenwriters Guild, and blacklisted by Hollywood studios. He served nearly a year in federal prison. The story of Dalton Trumbo is told now in a documentary that bears his name, simply Trumbo. It's directed by Peter Askin, based on a play by Dalton Trumbo's son, Christopher. And Peter Askin and Christopher Trumbo both join us to talk about the project. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
Thank you.
And Peter, let's start with you as the director. You have, as a device, many, many letters that Dalton Trumbo wrote over the long period of his blacklisting. They're read in the film by actors from Liam Neeson and Donald Sutherland to Michael Douglas.
Perhaps I should not be as angry as I am against the weaklings, the cravens, and liars who have succeeded in banning me from motion pictures, for I feel a sense of relief.
It's one thing for that to work on stage in a play. It's quite another thing to have it work on film. What was the challenge there?
The challenge really was to see how long we could sustain both a direct performance of the letters and intersperse that with visual footage which was relevant to what was being discussed. And what we discovered was that they could be sustained quite well.
Christopher Trumbo, let's bring you in here. You were, I believe, 10 years old when your father went to prison for being in contempt of Congress. How was it explained to you?
It's something that was revealed over a period of years. And it was presented to us as that he believed in one thing and the government believed in another, and he was going to have to go to prison for a short time.
I want to ask you about a painful scene in the movie. Chris, when your father has written a letter to the principal of your sister Mitzi's elementary school, she's 10 years old at the time in fifth grade, and she has been, as we learn, essentially blacklisted by her peers. Apparently the PTA has been meeting secretly about your parents, and all of that suspicion is filtered down to the children. Let's listen to part of this letter. It's read here by the actor David Strathairn.
Small childish conspiracies are directed against her, patterned in secret after the conspiracies of the parents. And she is quietly and incessantly persecuted and boycotted and shunned as long as the school day lasts. This slow murder of the mind and heart and spirit of a young child is the proud outcome of the patriotic meetings held by a few parents under the sponsorship of the PTA and the Bluebirds.
Peter Askin, do you remember when you first saw that letter, how you felt?
Just as moved as I am at the moment listening to David do it again. I think anyone who's a parent, and even if you're not, can empathize with those circumstances where you stand helplessly to one side and, you know, watch your child have to deal with something of that magnitude.
And knowing, too, that right or wrong, you have brought this on your child.
Of course. Of course.
Let's talk about the later chapter of Dalton Trumbo's writing life, because your father, Chris, did go on to have quite a prodigious writing life, but he's always writing under other names, a long list of pseudonyms that he has.
Yes, at least 13. As my sister said, there was never a wrong number as far as she was concerned. She just assumed that whoever it was, it was for him, whatever the name was.
Oh, people would be calling and asking for Sally Stubblefield, one of his names, or Marcel
exactly.
Klauber, things like that.
Yeah, sure.
Dad,
yeah,
it's for you.
That was the attitude.
Peter Askin, talk about that time with Dalton Trumbo writing under all of these names and the kinds of pieces he was writing.
Seemed like he would take whatever job that was offered to him. Some of them I don't think people have heard of, but there was a film like The Brave One, where she wrote under the pseudonym Robert Rich, which was nominated and then awarded an Academy Award. And I think it was at that point when the search commenced for Robert Rich. It was the only Academy Award that was never picked up at the awards. The night of the award, no Robert Rich came forward. The next day, I think six or seven Robert Riches came forward. But at that point, I think Trumbo believed that through the press, he was now in a position to begin to fight back and manipulate the press to his advantage, because he was questioned. There were suspicions that Trumbo was, in fact, Robert Rich.
We hear in the film Michael Douglas reading the words of Dalton Trumbo from this time when he finally says, you know, he has joked about this character, Robert Rich, before, but the time has come when it's no longer a joke.
I can invent no more witticisms about the Oscar he dares not claim, because that small, worthless golden statuette is covered with the blood of my friends. I cannot laugh about it any longer because my belly is filled with the poison of this blacklist, and my heart is filled with its grief, and my ears roar with rage at its injustices. And my heart, for the first time, is filled with something very close to hate.
Do you think the experience of everything that Dalton Trumbo went through with the blacklist, did it filter into his writing in the end? Peter Askin, what do you think?
Well, certainly we do find clips from different films where it's just too much of a coincidence that certain things that are spoken by actors or characters don't reflect back on his life.
What kinds of things are you thinking of?
Well, Spartacus, certainly.
I've got an example from Spartacus. There is the scene in Spartacus where Sir Laurence Olivier as Crassus asks the remains of this defeated slave army to reveal Spartacus or to show him the body of Spartacus. Kirk Douglas, as Spartacus, is about to stand up.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
Others stand up and say, I'm Spartacus. And what they are doing is they are refusing to let him betray himself. They are refusing to let him become an informer against himself. And it is the general who has solicited them all to become informers, and all of them resist.
Well, Peter Askin and Christopher Trumbo, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A young Iraqi film student catches the eye of a Hollywood up-and-comer. They make a deal for a cross-cultural exchange, and a documentarian comes to catch their relationship on film. It sounds like a nice story, but nothing turned out the way it was meant to, including the documentary, which is now opening across the country. Andrea Shea of member station WBUR in Boston reports on Operation Filmmaker.
Who knows? Operation Filmmaker might never have been made if actor-turned-director Liev Schreiber hadn't been channel surfing. In 2004, he stumbled on an MTV profile of a young Iraqi film student in Baghdad, Muthana Mohammed.
There is a famous place to show movies burned completely and damaged completely.
It basically was all about the moment when I saw him go to the book market and looking for books, anything, magazines, anything that had anything to do with film.
As it happens, Schreiber was getting ready to shoot his feature, Everything is Illuminated, in Prague. And he decided to help Muthana Mohammed by giving him an internship on an American
Baghdad
film
needs
set.
Filmmakers. I think Baghdad needs artists. I think Baghdad needs all of that. That was, I guess, my fantasy about Muthana.
Our sympathies are completely with him when we see the footage of the destroyed film school, and it's so poignant. He represents, you know, what's happened to the whole country, of course, but his personal story, I think, was very, very engaging.
Ross McElwee teaches documentary film at Harvard University. He's been a mentor to the director of Operation Filmmaker, Nina Davenport.
I was just interested in meeting a real live Iraqi as opposed to the parade of victims across the television screens.
Liev Schreiber hired Davenport to document Muthanna Mohammed's experience in Prague.
But I quickly saw that there was this conflict developing between Muthanna and his American benefactors on set.
The Americans expected Muthanna Mohammed to be grateful for his opportunity. Instead, he's blatantly resentful over having to fetch coffee and food for his higher-ups.
The most important scene was rolling in the set while I was mixing the snacks.
In Operation Filmmaker, Liev Schreiber and his producer Peter Sarif are appalled time and time again by Muthanna Mohammed. He's not impressed with the hierarchy on set. He parties instead of working. He asks for film equipment and money. Tensions escalate.
You don't want to say something that makes you look bad or makes me look bad or you think might make me angry at you. So you're always convoluting some kind of story. Just be straight.
Finally, the Americans wrap the shoot, leave Prague, and leave Muthanna Mohammed behind. But documentarian Nina Davenport stays to film him, doggedly. At this point, Operation Filmmaker becomes as much about her as Mohammed. After a while, though, he starts asking Davenport for help.
It wasn't, I want to go buy clothes. It was, I need money to get this visa, or I need money to survive. And I just found it impossible not to help him because there he was. I had money. He didn't. I'm an American. He's an Iraqi. How am I not going to help?
But when Davenport eventually does say no, he threatens to quit the film. He holds her tapes hostage. Then their relationship gets really ugly.
You're hurting me. I know you don't have any money,
sure,
but it's not my fault that you don't have any money. You spent the money. I'm not responsible for you.
Okay. This scene is a documentarian's nightmare. At a recent screening in Boston, filmmakers in the audience squirmed as Operation Filmmaker breaks boundaries and practically implodes before their eyes. Susan Steinberg was one of them.
It was absolutely terrifying. I could hardly bear to watch the film.
Muthanna Mohammed watched the film, and he says he hated the way he's portrayed, according to Davenport. He has a job in London now, waiting tables. Nina Davenport admits it's sometimes hard for her to accept that she's made a film that makes an Iraqi look unsympathetic. She also says if she knew how misguided the cross-cultural experiment was going to be, she never would have made Operation Filmmaker. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Shea.
Two movie comedies depend on a popular comedian. The Love Guru has Mike Myers of the Austin Powers movies. Get Smart has Steve Carell of TV's The Office. Both stars hone their skills in sketch comedy, but our critic Bob Mondello says they're now working in a very different style.
A Tale of Two Comics. It was the best of films. It was the worst of films. Well, Get Smart isn't quite the best of films, but Love Guru is definitely the worst. A far, far grosser thing than Mike Myers has ever done. Vulgar, unfunny, dirtier minded than its PG-13 rating suggests. It's the story of a very needy guru, played by a very needy Myers, who's hired to motivate the Toronto Maple Leafs. His methods include lewd self-help mantras, elephant erotica, and an endless supply of jokes about male endowment.
Damn.
Looks like he's smuggling a schnauzer.
Pretty much a single entendre, no? Hockey is apparently one of Mike Myers' passions. Deepak Chopra is another. And on the evidence presented in The Love Guru, a third is bodily functions.
Are you finished?
No! Now I'm finished.
The charitable way of characterizing this sort of humor, besides noting its appeal to third graders, is to say that it descends from burlesque. Descends rather a lot in this case. Myers grew up in Canada, where the British music hall tradition holds sway. Think Benny Hill. But nothing can quite prepare you for a whole movie filled with spiritualism filtered through that sensibility.
Fate is a joke. And as I once read on a wall in a truck stop bathroom, the joke is in your hands.
Myers surrounds himself with perfectly able second bananas, Justin Timberlake, Stephen Colbert, Ben Kingsley, and Vern Mini-Me Troyer, but none of them, not one, not for a moment, can find a way to be funny when the star's around. Get Smart is descended not from burlesque, but from its family-friendly cousin, vaudeville. The original TV show was the brainchild of Mel Brooks and Buck Henry, and when they conceived a bumbling secret agent Maxwell Smart, sort of a cross between Inspector Clouseau and James Bond, they gave him the rhythms of a Borscht Belt comic. While Steve Carell isn't really a stand-up guy, he's got those rhythms.
How do I know you're not Control?
If I were Control, you'd already be dead.
If you were Control, you'd already be dead.
Well, neither of us is dead, so I'm obviously not from Control.
That actually makes sense.
Carell is what you might call a smarter Maxwell Smart. He brings both brains and heart to the character's ineptitude, so it's easy to see why Anne Hathaway's Agent 99 might grow fond of him. The film isn't as wisecracky as the 60s series, but it's decent fun when Max is misconstruing or being misconstrued, when he tries to get an elderly Russian baker to tell him where she's hiding some nuclear material, for instance. He's just doing his job, not cracking jokes.
Free Ugala?
No, thank you. I am here for something else.
Bread?
Something hot.
We have rolls that just came out.
Even hotter. Much, much hotter.
I already have boyfriend.
All right.
Although I could make exception.
No, that's...
Sure.
Okay.
Flower sacks in back, very comfortable.
I don't think we are on the same page.
That exchange, you'll note, is all about sex, without being smutty. Considering that both The Love Guru and Get Smart have roots in the East-West divides of the 1960s and also have stars who were born during that decade, it's interesting that they're conceived and played so differently. The Love Guru's plot about Western fascination with Eastern spiritualism is barely even a clothesline to hang jokes on. Get Smart's spoofing of 007 movies is a fully formed spy flick. And Mike Myers wears his guru character much as he would a suit of clothes, winking at the camera to let you know he's in there. Steve Carell doesn't wink at the camera, he stares it down. And he doesn't wear Maxwell Smart, he inhabits him. Or maybe just turns him into Steve Carell. I'm Bob Mondello.
When we hear stories about Muslim immigrants in Europe, it's often about conflict between the culture they were born into and the countries where they live. And the subtext of those stories is frequently that these immigrants are somehow dangerous to their new homelands. But that narrative denies the complexity of South Asians who are trying to build a future for their families in unfamiliar and sometimes hostile nations. And that complexity is captured in the film Brick Lane, the story of one Bangladeshi woman who comes to London for an arranged marriage, but changes the course of her life when she has an affair with a younger man.
I do not want to marry you, Gurin.
Right. You don't want to marry me.
I am not the real thing. I'm no longer a girl from the village.
Yes, you are.
No. You just wanted me to be.
Brick Lane won critical acclaim in Britain last year and is now opening in limited release across America. Tanishta Chatterjee stars in Brick Lane, and Sarah Gavran directed the film, and they both join us now. Welcome.
Thanks for inviting us here.
Yes, thank you.
Sarah, let's begin with you. Tell me what drew you to the project.
Well, there was so much, really. I mean, I read the novel when it first came out, mm-hmm. and everybody in the UK read it, and it connected with people across cultures and across generations, I think, because although it's set in this very particular world of the Bangladeshi community in East London, it is a universal story. And then I was approached to direct it as a film, and I just thought, although it's daunting, it was irresistible. There was so much in the story, and primarily the story of Nazneen, a woman finding her voice and mm-hmm. her place in the world.
Mm-hmm. Tanishta, tell us about Nazneen, your character. Who is she?
Well, she's a woman who comes from a small place in Bangladesh, and at the age of 17, her father decides to marry her off to a man who's 25 years older to her and whom she's never met. And so she gets transported to this alien land, you know, to London, where she doesn't understand the language, she doesn't communicate with anyone, and she has three children. Her son dies and she brings up her daughters, and she has a relationship with a younger man. And she explores herself and finds her own voice in her own ways. And mm-hmm. that's the journey of the character through the film.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering what personal experiences you might have drawn on in portraying her.
It's not always personal experiences, but yeah, to some extent, you know, my grandmother was, I'm Indian, but she was from what is called the other side of Bengal, which, like, India during partition was, it became Pakistan, Bangladesh and India. And the eastern part of India was divided into West Bengal and East Bengal. East Bengal became Bangladesh and West Bengal became the Indian side of Bengal. And it was divided on the basis of religion. And the Muslims lived on the other side of Bengal and the Hindus came to India. So my grandmother during partition had come to India. So for right from my childhood, I had heard stories from her about the other side of Bengal and how the fish of that particular river was better than this side of Bengal. And it was strange that through my formative years where I grew up, I never had that particular fish in India. But in London, when I met all these Bangladeshi women, when I was doing my research for my character, I actually had that particular fish in their homes.
Yeah. So you could go back and tell your family, I know what it is now. Well, Sarah, this film is based on Monica Ellie's book, as you mentioned, Brick Lane, about the Bangladeshi immigrant experience, but in the 1980s in London. And you set the movie in more recent times so that the September 11th attacks were in the film, and they really become a pivotal event in the story. I was interested. Why did you add that to the story?
We decided by focusing on the year of 2001 and looking at it through the prism of that year, we could show the cultural shifts in the sort of landscape of London and how it was changing people, radicalising the young lover, Kareem, and changing Chanu, the husband character, making him more keen to go back to Bangladesh. And also it's the year in which Nazneen really transforms as a character because she meets her lover who opens her eyes and is a catalyst to her change.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tanishta, your character, like many young women, is not allowed to make her own choices. And as you mentioned, her father arranges a marriage that takes her away from home and from her really beloved sister that she has.
Right.
We have this clip that I want to play.
I always said, I will not marry and be sent far away. I will go no further than these paddy fields. But our mother told us, we must not run from our fate. What cannot be changed must be born. The test of life is to endure.
Mama?
And I remembered her saying, if Allah wanted us to ask questions, he would have made us men.
You know, that line really got me. The test of life is to endure.
Yes.
It was like, oh my God.
And she repeats it. It's very strange. Like, through the film, she repeats it. And mm-hmm. she's actually unable to express herself, unable to do anything about this life that, you know, fate has kind of destined for her. She just accepts it. But in a way, what her mother told her as a child, you know, the test of life is to endure and let's, you know, wait for that destiny. She kind of tries to change that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was wondering if her faith in her status as an immigrant, whether or not that fed into her resignation as a person who didn't have control over her own fate.
Yeah, I think, you know, I met a lot of Bangladeshi women in and around Brick Lane. And many of them had similar stories. When they came to England, they were very young, in their early teens, 16, 17 years old, arranged marriage situation. And they didn't speak the language. They were completely alienated. They cocooned themselves in that flat for years and they wouldn't even go out. The fear of the unknown was so daunting on them that they just wouldn't have the courage to do anything.
Yeah.
And you can imagine a girl who's never traveled outside her own village, who doesn't speak a language, who's suddenly transported to another part of the world in a culture which she doesn't identify with, neither with the language, costume, the dress, the food, nothing. And then how would she have the courage to explore herself?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sarah, I think a lot of Westerners think of immigrants as leaving some terrible oppression in their home countries for the relative paradise of the West. And Nazneen's story is just about the opposite.
Yes.
And do you think that this story has the potential really to kind of change the way that we in the West see South Asian immigrants?
Yeah, well, I hope, you know, film does have that way of changing the way you see things and breaking down boundaries. And just the very fact that people can connect with Nazneen as a character means that she's less of an outsider, you know, and you understand where she's coming from. And as you say, her lost childhood is a sort of powerful magnet, and the grim reality of living in London and what that means to her, although eventually she does find home there. Mm-hmm. I think very much it's about not your expectations, and the story isn't about those stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. This film was controversial in Britain even before it came out in theaters.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I understand, some members of the Bangladeshi community there protested that the film was a negative portrayal of Bangladeshis. And Sarah, how did you respond to that argument?
Yes, well, it's worth unpacking that, because what happened is we went in about 8 months before filming it. And because I was an outsider to the community, although I lived in London, I wasn't Bangladeshi, I knew that it was very, very important for me to work with a lot of Bangladeshi community members from East London. So I took on board cast and crew, and they welcomed us, actually, and people opened their doors to Tanishtha for her research and other crew and cast members. So we had a very good experience. And people believed it was important we make the film and recognised it was a fiction and not a representation of that mm-hmm. community, just one story. But it was when we were filming, we were about 3 weeks into filming, that we got this call at midnight, rather dramatically, just before we were about to shoot on Brick Lane itself, saying there was this threat that if we shot there, some of people might be hurt.
Really?
Yeah, so we took that seriously, and we relocated the next day's filming and we investigated. But it turned out to be this tiny group, if vocal group, who mm-hmm. was talking about some scenes that weren't even in the film or the book.
Okay.
And probably underlying their concerns was the fact that it was a story of a woman finding, you know, independence.
I was wondering how much of it was related to the fact that that woman finding her independence
Absolutely.
Also had an affair with a younger man.
Yeah, I think that they were objecting to that. But what was sort of evident quickly was that they didn't represent the majority view. And we got a lot of people from the Bangladeshi community saying, we believe in freedom of expression. We believe this is a legitimate project. So we didn't change anything in the story. And we just filmed in other places and came back to Brick Lane once the protests had died down.
Tanishtha, part of your character's evolution is a change in the way she views her husband. In the film, he kind of seems to be a buffoon at first.
Yes.
But later he's revealed to be more insightful than he's given credit for. And we have a clip from a scene where Nazneen's husband challenges some young Muslims about their newfound brotherhood.
Yes.
Okay, let's take a listen.
We've become victims. But not for long.
Yeah.
We stand arm in arm with our Muslim brothers, ready to defend.
What is it you plan to defend?
Islam, brother.
No. Let the brother speak. Let the brother speak.
You think Islam unites us all?
Yes.
You think Islam is the place you come from? Islam is not a country. You think you are my brother more than the next man on the street because we are both Muslims? All this fighting talk that we are all brothers. 3 million died in East Pakistan in this lifetime. It was Muslim killing a Muslim. Have you forgotten? Are you so lost? My Islam is in here. And that is the only thing worth defending.
That's Satish Kaushik as Shanu Ahmed. How do you feel about the way Western films generally portray South Asian couples who are part of arranged marriages?
I think that's what is unique about this film. It actually doesn't judge arranged marriages. But in doing that, it also allows this woman to explore her teenage infatuation through this young man, you know, Kareem, because she does get married to Chanu at a very young age without her being a part of that decision. So for her, I mean, Kareem is the only other man she ever knows. So it's not all about that particular man, but maybe it's just a catalyst for her to explore what is it that she wants and how does she find a voice of her own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sarah, what do you want people to take away from this film?
Well, from my point of view, I think it's, you know, many things, and I'm glad if it provokes thought. But I feel it's a hopeful film of integration of a woman who finds her place in a country that's for so long not been home. Mm-hmm. And also it's a story about how life circles and we get the opportunity to make better choices.
And Tanisha, what do you want people to take away?
It's a universal story. Like what Sarah went to a festival in San Sebastian, and a Spanish woman from a very small village there came up to her with her son and said that my son wants to kiss you to put my life into the film. Wow. And that's the connection that people make. So That's what I want people to take from the film. Yeah.
Tanisha Chatterjee stars in Brick Lane. Sarah Gavran directed the film. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us here. Thanks.